And so now we're ready to move on to our next panel, which is going to be about mental health. And we're going to have Linda Johnson, and I think Jeff is actually going to introduce the panel, if I'm not mistaken. Jeff, are you on the...
I am on.
Good. Okay. Why don't I go ahead and just turn it over to you and get things rolling.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. So before I start, I want to give credit to my co-facilitator on this effort, Alice Turner. And, you know, the pandemic has underscored for all Americans, and specifically those of us with vision loss, the seriousness of our mental health concerns. But in reality, among people who are blind or who have low vision, mental health problems have been a real understated opportunity for decades. I remember hearing, you know, when I was first part of this organization and for years to follow, well, all you have to do is, you know, you lose your vision, you just have to learn that blindness is not really a problem, you just have to learn how to cope with it. And it's not a big deal. It's not a mental health problem. It's just, you know, getting those blindness skills. Well, that was obviously a mythical and a view that really was not borne out to be at all true. And as decades have gone on, we realized how serious these issues are, not only for folks who lose their vision later in life, but also for those that are adventitiously blind. And so I think the time has passed come, long past come, when our community really does a better job of addressing this issue. And today we have with us two panelists who I think you're going to enjoy hearing from. Our first panelist is Roque Buckton from Duarte. Roque is a member of the State Independent Living Council. He is a strong and passionate advocate for mental health services in California, and specifically in LA County, where he serves in a number of capacities dealing with projects on mental health. And he is a low vision individual. So you will be hearing from him in just a minute. Our other panelist is someone whom many of you know from Northern California, Linda Johnson. She is also a person with vision loss and a ardent mental health services advocate, but she is also a blind marriage, family, and child therapist. So she is a clinician as well as an advocate. So what Alice and I have decided to do is that I have come up with some questions that I am going to be asking these folks, and I am sure we will have time for your questions as well. So let me start, and I'm going to let them just take it at whomever wants to go. I'm not going to, you know, say who should talk about this first, but and they can both obviously address any of these questions. In your experience, what do you think are the commonalities and differences between the mental health challenges faced by those who are congenitally blind as opposed to those who are adventitiously blind or low vision? Either one of you want to take a shot at that?
Face. Mute. Currently unmute.
Hi, this is Roque. Hello, everyone. Thank you for hosting this event. I appreciate the opportunity to speak about this topic. My name is Roque Alas Buktan. As mentioned earlier, I've been doing quite a bit of work in the disabilities and mental health sector. I was the Access for All co-chair. Access for All is the advisory committee for the LA County Department of Mental Health. And currently, I'm conducting on behalf of the Department of Mental Health with the nonprofit that I work for, Painted Brain. We're running a disabilities mental health needs assessment for the entire county. We're running a series of focus groups to get feedback about services and obstacles and appropriate accommodations, et cetera. And we'll be publishing that info and study. So if you could be so kind as to refresh and restate the question, please.
Sure. The question is basically, what do you think are the commonalities and differences between the mental health challenges faced by those who are congenitally blind as opposed to those who lose their vision later in life?
I can say just from having run focus groups now since January, there's a lot of feedback about how people lose their sight, especially those who are going through the experience of diminishing ability in their sight. And that seems to be some of the most difficult populations. And I hear that from other organizations in Los Angeles, like that's the primary population that they want to develop services for, develop peer support groups for. That's just my experience and in just personal interactions with people. I have retinitis pigmentosa and some other issues with my eyes. And so I lost my eyesight over time. And it was very, very difficult to experience sight loss. And I would say one of the things that was probably causing a great deal of suffering in me was grasping after sight, like just remembering the things I used to be able to do and wanting to still do those things. Once I sort of let go of that and just accepted my state of sight, I was much better. It was a great deal of healing, and I was very mindful about that. It was the grasping after sight, and it wasn't acceptance or something like that, because I wasn't very happy with the condition still, and that caused other mental health conditions to arise. But it was understanding that what the root cause of my biggest issue was, and then I just consistently developed better mental health practices over time. Not that I'm perfect in any way, shape, or form. It's more like just maintenance, keeping it together like we all do. There's like so many stresses and pressures plus our disability. So it's just an overall wellness approach.
Linda.
Hi. So this is Linda Johnson, and I've been at this since 1988, and I lost my vision to retinitis pigmentosa. And I'll just be real brief on the history piece, because I think it's really important, because it mimics or echoes what Jeff mentioned about blindness skills. So I'm now 63. So when I was in my mid-20s, my RP was getting to a point where I couldn't fake it anymore. I had to really start addressing my issues. And I come from a very loving and supportive family, and we talked about everything. So that wasn't the issue at that time, but it was more like, how do I do this emotionally? I was really scared. I was really depressed. I had a lot of anxiety. And so everywhere I looked, it was, well, you can learn Braille, you can learn a white cane, or get your house adapted through daily living skills. And at that point, I still had about 10 degrees of vision. And so as we all know, like when you have a vision loss, your brain is able to, you know, fill in the blanks, so to speak. And I didn't need that. I wanted to talk to a therapist that was blind or visually impaired, and I wanted a support group. And none of that at that time I could not find. So I started the California RP support group, and it started in my parents' house with 8 people. And by 1992, it grew to over 490 something people. And we turned it into a nonprofit. But this launched my whole passion to really focus on this area of mental health and vision loss. And so I, let's see, there's so much in my head. So what happens here is a variety of things. So with the congenital blindness and adventitious blindness. So I did a couple projects for school. One of them was I did a study where I was wondering about middle schoolers who had experienced vision loss. They were congenitally, you know, visually impaired. So, because I was wondering, because at that stage of life, a child is focusing on their particular difference. Like their nose might be too big, their ears might be sticking out, and they might be heavy. So, and then they feel everybody is staring at that one thing that they're having, you know, concerns about or don't like about themselves or feel different. And so I was wondering if that would be a part of a child's life who was living with vision loss. So, and in some cases it was, they didn't want to be using the white cane. So a lot of times they just walk around without the white cane. And then I furthered that with going in when I was working at Vista Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired. I ran a support group for transition age group kids that were 13 to about 20. And for most of the time, everybody's okay with where they are because that's what they know. You know, they didn't know what it was like to have, say, 20/20 vision or full range of vision. And I didn't either. I didn't know full range of vision because I never got a driver's license, but I knew what 20/20 was. And so anyway, their issues became more about dating and socialization and that sort of thing. And wanting, you know, they can't do the driver's license. So they're kind of set apart from their peers. And so transportation is an issue. And I think with all of us who have been diagnosed at an early age, I was diagnosed at age 8. My parents are very open about what I had, didn't understand it. I go, well, everybody sees this way. And I think that that does happen. And so, but I think when it happens for children, the parents are the first ones to deal with the trauma. And so, am I taking too long here, Jeff? So
you're good.
Okay, you're good. I'll wrap this up in a minute. And so then, when I was going through this issue of my vision loss, and I couldn't fit the grieving process into it. Yeah, I'm grieving this loss. This is really hard. I really hated it. You know, quite honestly, there was a time where I didn't see a point of life, but I wasn't, so to speak, quote unquote, suicidal. I literally felt so overwhelmed. I see it as a metaphor for feeling so overwhelmed with not knowing what to do. It's just, you know, I don't understand the point here. So this happens with people that start maybe they've lost their, you know, a gradual loss of vision. This can happen. Like I do talk about this with people. Okay. And one of the things that I saw was that this is more than just the grieving process, but this is really a trauma. And so I did my master's thesis on PTSD and blindness and interviewed 74 people. And come to find out that people that do have a gradual loss of vision, experiencing a gradual loss of vision versus a sudden loss, are slightly higher in the symptomology of PTSD, which is a lot of anxiety. It's in what Roque was talking about, that whole concept of remembering what it was like to see. In PTSD, that is what the first criteria is: nightmares, disturbing dreams, disturbing thoughts, or disturbing memories. And to have PTSD, it's, you can have a chronic illness that can create PTSD. I'm not saying we're all having PTSD here. I'm just framing it as a trauma. And so the disturbing thoughts and memories is remembering what it was like to see, oh my gosh, last year I could see all the lights on the Christmas tree. Now I can't. And just, and I'll wrap this up here with this, is that in my practice, I did a little statistics here. Over the past 6 months, I've seen 47 people. It's been crazy with the pandemic. It is just so, well, how much are wanting. Out of those 47, 70% of the people I see are dealing with vision loss in their life. Then of that 70%, 51% of them are over the age of 57. And then 27% are 13 to 40. So I am getting increasing amounts of people that are older, and these, their jobs have been established. Well, some of these architects, artists, lawyers, doctors, you name it, it doesn't matter. And so all of a sudden, they're unable to do what they used to be able to do. So, and I'll wrap it up there. So I think it's like with the picture I like is when we're older, it's like I see life as a jigsaw puzzle. We put all these pieces together, and we set our life. Then when vision loss changes majorly, or somebody's diagnosed with a vision loss, it's like a pair of mysterious hands comes out and grabs a hold of that puzzle and turns it upside down and goes, okay, let's put this all back together again. And some of those pieces are still very, very connected, because it's your foundation, your personality, there's all these different things, but then it's putting all the other pieces in. Okay, I'm done. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so, you know, we have some recent data through the Aging and Vision Loss National Coalition from California Medicare and Census data that indicate that older adults with vision loss are far more likely to have serious mental health problems than are other older adults. So this is not at all surprising to anyone. So what do you think are the services in the mental health sphere that folks with vision loss most need, and that we, you know, we're advocating right now to increase the availability of services? What does our population need the most, do you think?
Jeff, this is Andrea on the panel. Could I make a really quick comment?
Can we wait on your comment until they have had a chance to?
Certainly.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, Jeff, this is Linda. I think that I love support groups. I facilitated so many support groups, and that's, you know, how I got hired with Vista and my whole start. I really feel support groups are very powerful. I think even stepping it up and moving it to a counseling group, because I've done those for Vista too, where it's not just focused on sharing of technology and that sort of thing, which is very important, but it's a different level. It really starts addressing, you know, the emotional impact and what people are feeling on a, you know, psychological level.
Okay.
And of course, more therapists that are blind.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Roque speaking. Yes, I concur with what Linda says. In my experience with the focus groups, the feedback is that they want a peer environment. They want facilitators, clinicians, therapists with lived experience. That's pretty much across the board. they feel uncomfortable having to explain what their disability is to someone who doesn't have that sort of experience, and they don't feel there's a real connection. Peer groups, I think, are really powerful in the way they can heal, the way they can address intersectional issues. So one of the things that, once again, Access for All, I proposed and drafted another project, which is a peer support group for people with disabilities, but with a little more cultural competency. So we're borrowing from the talk circle model. That's being implemented. Now it's in the vendor solicitation process, and that'll be rolling out later this year. So I think also with SB 803 and all the peer development with Medi-Cal, I'm also have been advocating for the subcategory of disability peer specialist, so that people with disabilities can actually have that certification, which they had prior to this new implementation that they're developing. They don't have, currently they don't have a disability peer specialist as a subcategory of peer specialist. For example, they have substance abuse or domestic violence, et cetera. But they don't currently have that. So I'm here advocating and rallying folks to speak up and address this and really make this an issue to bring that certification specialty back and allow folks with disabilities, with lived experience, to be able to facilitate peer support groups. I think it can be a real game changer for the peers, because they can build Medi-Cal. So it's a pathway for folks to find employment and also support in their local area, because they can just form peer support groups. Instead of having to go through an organization, they would be certified, and then they could initiate and make little support groups in their little areas, you know, wherever they happen to be, very hyper-local kind of situations. And I think this would be really good. So I do concur with Alinda.
Well, that's great. I hope if our bill from California Council of Blind, AB 1999, on mental health services is successful, that maybe we can have LA County as one of those Medi-Cal pilot projects and do some of the things that you are advocating. So, you know, we welcome everyone's help on that, what I think is an extremely important bill. What do you think that mental health practitioners and public officials making decisions about funding and the provision of mental health services to people with vision loss need to know with respect to meeting our needs? I know you've partly addressed it, but...
Well, I think that... I feel that some of the issues, because I think there needs to be more in-services, I believe, you know, that would help mental health practitioners to understand the different emotions that people are feeling and what is a part of it. I'm hoping I'm addressing your question. For instance, there's a lot of role reversals if it's later in life. If the man, if the male loses his vision and he might have been doing, you know, different tasks, or the female, then the other partner ends up having to take over and help or assist this person. So, and then it becomes more of a caregiving situation. So just even in relationships, there's a lot that does occur. One thing I've noticed is it's kind of a sense of an identity crisis. Like, who am I? You know, people feel like they're a different person. And there's also this hypervigilance, feeling on guard. Part of my, in my thesis research, most everybody that I interviewed rated 4 or 5 on a Likert scale of 1 to 5, and 5 being extreme. They rated either 4 or 5 on hypervigilant and feeling on guard. And then the avoidance, you know, there's a tendency to avoid. And I feel that it's really meeting people where they're at. You know, I think even a person who has a clinician that, you know, doesn't have a sight impairment can really meet a person where they're at and understand them, and not just to always focus on the blindness, you know, to go beyond that and to see how things work together. Hope that answered your question.
Before I go to Roque for a second, let me follow up with you, Linda. What about the need for peer groups and supports for family, for caregivers and other family members? What about that? Does any of that exist? Is it far too little, or what do you think?
Far too little. But when I work with my little kiddos, I definitely talk with the parents. And helping the parents allow is a weird word, but, you know, helping that parent to give the space for their child to make mistakes, maybe. They don't have to be perfect, or helping them to learn how to advocate for themselves. And the parents are going through a lot. In my case, you know, my mom was extremely guilty. She felt so guilty, even though I have the recessive type of RP, which meant both my parents have the gene. It just so happened to come together when I was born, or, you know, conceived. But there's a lot of guilt for parents. And I'm working with this other little girl that's, I shouldn't say little, but 15. And she got diagnosed 2 years ago with Cone-rod dystrophy. And the parents fell apart in the ophthalmology office. And now this young girl doesn't even want to talk to her parents because she's afraid that they're going to fall apart. So there is definitely a need, you know, for, you know, parents and caregivers to have a place to understand.
Okay, Roque, comments for you on either of these?
Yes, this is Roque speaking. Linda, thank you for those great points. I really echo many of the things that you were saying. And Jeff, can I ask you once again to please restate the question? Because I just want to stay on track with what you were asking.
Sure, absolutely. The first question, the first really part of that is, and I can really expand it into one, is what do you think that we need to be telling public officials and practitioners who make decisions and who impact the lives of people with vision loss that have mental health challenges? What do we think that we need to be telling those folks? And the second part is, do we need to do more to provide caregiver support?
Okay, great. Thank you. So in my experience, dealing with the LA County Department of Mental Health and the way they structure the programs and the budgeting, there are issues that they are marginalizing. They're funding, you know, a protected class, people with disabilities that have ADA rights, and they're not putting the line items as priority line items. You know, they're after the fact in the design of a project or a proposal. Then they look at it, and then there'll be like a 0.5 something in the budget. And we're talking multi-billion budgets. So they're fractions of fractions. And the design, because it's a protected class with rights, it should be as a top line item, meaning you don't design the project and put that at the end and think about it last, but you actually have to put it in the design. So meaning accessibility, accommodations, etc., cultural competencies. That's why one of the things that we started doing at Access for All for the Department of Mental Health was education. So I facilitated a couple of assistive technology workshops that, and I say workshops because they were immersive. It wasn't just a PowerPoint and just reading across some bullets. It was immersing the clinicians, the staff into the environment of assistive technology, teaching them how to speak to each other in regards to dealing with people with disabilities, you know, what sort of language is appropriate when you're dealing with someone with vision loss, et cetera. You know, the first person first language, all these various layers of cultural competencies that need to be designed into the projects, programs, and proposals at the top, not after the fact, and design an entire program and then have to retrofit. So it's an approach of universal design, inclusive design, such that from the initial outset, these things are thought of, integrated. So some of the things that I've also proposed to the department is job development. So internally, two things. Their HR department's actively looking for people that fit like particular profiles, meaning either they have American Sign Language, assistive technology backgrounds, that they are actually people with lived experience and have therapeutic credentials. Also to encourage that pipeline where like within the schools, in particular certain junior colleges in LA that have the specialty, certain universities, and to let the students know that there is a career path, because a lot of people get certain training, et cetera, and then they're just kind of floating, looking for work wherever they can grab it. So connecting those, making the linkages, getting the people to be in those places. And then the other part of that in terms of personnel development is to give them those skills so that they can actually, you know, move up in their pay scale. You know, like, so let's say teaching sign language, teaching them assistive technology, getting them orientation, mobilitation skills, all those sorts of things can develop their current workforce since they already have credentials, and then they can develop broader skill sets and they can work internally to develop. So those are some of the things that we proposed. And we've actively been working to increase budgets so that people with disabilities can design their own programs. So just some good news, the LA County Department of Mental Health has an underserved cultural communities set of advisory committees. So they're ethnically and linguistically based primarily. However, there are two other committees that are, one is the Cultural Competency Committee, and then there's Access for All, the one for people with disabilities. They have increased the budget from 200,000 fiscal to 350. So that allows for a little more development of projects that can go out to a bid, and the community can design what they want to design, which is a very grassroots, bottom up from the people approach, which is really refreshing. And I do give a lot of credit to the director, Dr. Sharon, who unfortunately is stepping down due to health reasons, but he was instrumental in really making a great effort to get community feedback into the process instead of a top-down clinician and like a project developer perspective, and really pushing for that and really looking at how the implementation and the proposal forming process gets much more community feedback prior to the implementation. Sorry for all the technical details, but.
Okay, so before I open it up to the panel, and Andrea, if you are back on, I'm not sure whether you were on or not, but I'll recognize you first. Before I do that, any final comments from either of you with respect to anything that's been said this morning or that you haven't been able to say and that you would like to.
One quick thing about the caregivers. This is a huge issue. There's a lot of undocumented people being exploited in the caregiver network as it is now. They're underpaid for sure, and very little benefits, etc. So I know there's a lot of movement in that area to kind of restore justice and make it a much more healthy environment for everyone involved. It's a very tough position.
Mm-hmm.
And if we do have
hang on, Linda, anything?
Sorry, I just wanted to say that I just really appreciate everybody's attention to this issue and that it's really coming to light, because it is just so valuable to be really recognizing this. And Roque, I just admire what you're doing. It's just amazing work. And so thank you, Jeff and Alice and everybody being here today.
Okay, so is Andrea back? I know it seemed like she left.
She had left.
Okay, well, if she returns, we'll recognize her. We have a hand, you say?
We do have a hand, Valerie. And you should be able to talk.
Hey, Valerie.
Thank you so much. I didn't see that button earlier. I'm really enjoying this presentation. I want to thank you both for being here today. I have two questions. One is, what percentage of those that are visually impaired that go to work are successful in keeping their jobs? And my second question is, what percentage of visually impaired people, including the blind, have dysfunctional families or suffer abuse in their families? Thank you.
Boy, I don't have that data at the top of my head. I mean, we know the unemployment data is around 70%, and that's usually the statistic that's quoted. The second one I can't say, but we also know that among people with disabilities, there is a heightened degree of dysfunctional families that are created. But I don't have statistics. I don't know if either of you do. Those are pretty good questions, though, Valerie.
Yeah. I don't have the statistics, but I think it's parents learning how to work with their children, just like in any case. But I'll just give an example. My young kiddo, very established family, but the issue was, the father was very, really putting a lot of pressure on his daughter. And this then increased her anxiety and her depression, actually yelling at her basically and this was during pandemic. And so she had to be on the Zoom call, and it was muted, while her yelled at to do a better job. But she was doing the best she could, and she actually was doing great. And she had to put on this smiley face because she was on the camera. And so there just needs to be some education about, and these are very good people. It's just the pandemic, it just created so much tension. Anyway, I don't know what the statistics are, though.
Yeah, it's funny. Every culture has different ways of handling things. I remember an instance in Sacramento maybe 15 years ago. The year's blurred in my mind now, but this young woman was accepted to UC Berkeley, and she was going to be an accounting business type major. And her father wanted to make sure that she was going to do well, so he actually moved with her to Berkeley. And lived there, and I suspect that hindered her college experience a little bit, maybe. But but you know, so you just never know. And she was obviously a blind person. Yeah. I didn't say that, but she was. So anyway, you just don't know.
Hey, this is Roque. There's some anecdotal things that I've come across. I've definitely heard about the 70% unemployment across the board for people with disabilities. It's really tough. However, what I've also heard is that once a disabled person gets a job, they retain it. And I think one of the challenges too is HR departments, and they're not really understanding what the, you know, let's say reasonable accommodation, you know, for people with disabilities is, what that entails. They're like, is there, you know, what the risk factors are, or, you know, are they going to get sued if this person, you know, has an accident on the job, etc. All those sorts of things. So I think that part of it, as has been stated, is education about what, you know, reasonable accommodations are in the workplace for people with disabilities, to really understand that, to have sort of that, you know, part of the training. You know, when you get onboarded for many companies, you go through an HR process, and that, I think that is one of the missing components, is that they should really look at how reasonable accommodations are managed within the company, and how the person with disabilities goes about that process. And I know for many companies, it's a learning curve, because it might be the first time they've ever had to deal with someone with a disability. You know, what does it mean to have assistive technology? What kind of accommodations? You know, what's the safety issues? There's stairs here at this facility, et cetera, et cetera. That's one thing for sure that I think could help and provide a better pathway for employment, is that component of education about reasonable accommodations. The other question, Valerie, I just really don't have any data on. It's a very good question, but maybe for another panel. Good topic for it.
Do we have any other hands?
Yes, we do. Next is Robert Acosta.
Okay, I think you can hear me. You'll tell me if you can.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm a strange bird here. I'm congenitally blind. And I want to say to Roque, is it?
Yeah.
That I think it was, that as a disabled guy, I was a school teacher of sighted children, the first one with LA Unified. And 37 years later, I walked out on my own. They didn't have to carry me out by the handles. I loved it, and it was great. So we do try to hold on to our jobs. My question is two of them. One, did you guys who were losing your sight, yes, go to family? My family was very good. I never had it, so they had to deal with, you know, we went to the eye doctor who said, look at my nose. I said, if I could, I wouldn't be here. You know, the eye doctor's a mechanic. He knows nothing. The ones I dealt with about rehab, healers, we did it all as congenitally blind guys. My questions are, did you consider, Roque and Linda, as you lost your sight, going to the orientation center for the blind to learn to be blind? It's not the greatest. I'd rather be a millionaire, but you can learn how to do it and get family out of it. Family's well-meaning many times, but they don't know about it either. And the second question, Linda, finding a therapist who understands blindness. How do we do that? I've had a few that didn't know blindness from anything. I mean, it was awful. Some were outstanding, not therapy, but guidance counselors. Maybe I need therapy. A lot of my friends say I do. Thank you.
Sound good to me. You sound like you're in really good mental health. Just a quick story on my side. When I started losing my sight, I went to the Braille Institute to apply, but I wasn't legally blind yet, you know, but I was really suffering the impact of mobility issues. You know, I was having much more trouble, etc. And my mom took me there, and they said, you know, you don't quite fit the criteria, because I brought my medical, you know, ophthalmological examination, et cetera, et cetera. But I wasn't blind enough to get services. So that impacted me even more, and my mom even more. And so I remember going to a very kind ophthalmologist and explaining what had happened at my next eye exam. And she was like, well, what is like your worst like if when you are most impaired, like when can you not see? And I said, well, you know, when I'm in really bright light, I get this kind of whiteout experience. You know, like it's common with a lot of folks mm-hmm. with RP. It's too bright. And then I get a whiteout experience. I can't see. So she said, well, just stare out that window for about 20 minutes. I'll come back and then I'll do your eye test.
That's a great story.
I love it.
Love it too. That's cool. Yeah.
You wanted to restate his question?
I've got it. The Orientation Center for the Blind. I think for me it was really emotional. I was really struggling with what am I going to do with my life? I know I'm losing my eyesight. And it was more like I really needed to do the emotional piece. And then as my vision got worse, I definitely used a cane, even though I didn't want to, but I wanted to get a guide dog. So that's the reason I did it. But, you know, so I kind of piecemealed it. I didn't go because I at that point, I just wasn't ready to do the concrete skill building. I really needed to learn how to live with this emotionally. And I'll never forget the first time I touched a white cane. It went through my hand so fast. Like, I didn't want to identify with it. But, you know, obviously I have now. But with finding a therapist, yeah. So there's a couple ways you can do this, is that there's in your area, you might have your Braille Institute, the Lighthouse for the Blind, the Society for the Blind, the Vista Center, Lions, whatever it is. A lot of times they might know of somebody. So I get referrals quite often through different centers. Then one thing you can do is say you do find somebody that is living the experience in is a therapist or clinician, and you have insurance, you can request for a single case agreement if that therapist is willing to do it, even though that therapist may not provide. So I provide for Medi-Cal and for the Veterans Administration. However, I get single case agreements through, say, Blue Shield, not Medicare, but Blue Shield and such, different ones because of the specialty, because they don't have a therapist that addresses that. So you can always go through your insurance also and find a therapist and interview this therapist. Good. You know, talk to them about what you're going through, what, and ask them what, are they cognitive behavioral therapists? Are they psychoanalysts or solution-based therapists? It's just really ask them. And the whole thing is about you. Not about the therapist's agenda. If that therapist cannot meet you where you're at and address what you're going through, it's okay to change.
Okay. Do we have any other hands?
Oh my gosh, we have 7 hands raised.
Okay, so let's try to ask questions quickly so we can get a few of them in, and quick answers too if you guys can.
Okay.
Okay, the next one is ending in 155.
Okay, Roger, I think.
Roger.
Okay, here I am. I am probably unusual in this crowd. I'm unusual in most every crowd. And that's really the story of my life. So I'm 80 years old now, and I was born blind. And when I think back on my life, especially my early life, the first word that comes to mind is alone. Mm-hmm. I went to the Idaho State School for the Deaf and Blind which was which might as well have been a prison or something. It was not, there was nobody there that I had anything in common with except blindness, including the staff. I don't think any of the staff were qualified for what they were doing. And it was pretty miserable. And actually, I got my own cane. The school didn't want me to have a cane, but I got one.
Hmm. Roger, do you have a question for our panelists?
No, I think I know more than they do.
Well, maybe you do, Roger. You know quite a lot.
I do, Roger.
But I do want to give other people a chance too. So,
but anyway, I just wanted to point out that I don't think I really got into a group that I was comfortable with and knew where I was in society or whatever until I was probably a junior in high school. And I think that, you know, I've been watching other people, and I believe that the best people that I've seen in terms of their adjustment and their happiness and so forth are some of these folks that have some combination of public education and some sort of blindness group. Like, I'm thinking like the people here in Santa Clara County, the Susan Glasses mm-hmm. of the world. They're not just in blind groups, and they're not the only blind person in the world. Thank you.
Right.
Thank you, Roger. If you don't listen to what Roger has to say, then you're really missing out because he knows his stuff. All right, next hand.
All right, the next hand is Regina, and you should be able to talk. Okay, you should be able to talk now, Regina. I'm sorry.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
So my question is really related. So as someone that has been blind most of my life, how can I best support people who are losing their vision? Because it's different. And I know that possibly inadvertently, I have done things that maybe didn't support someone so well. And also I've heard in workshops where there's a lot of sort of judgment that comes through, probably unintentional from us that have lived with it so long. Thanks.
Hi, this is Roque.
Go ahead, Roque. You go first.
I just wanted to share that there's a big push for the peer certification trainings. And so they're offering a lot of peer training courses. I'm taking a refresher course, you know, to be grandparented in for my certification. But those courses are really phenomenal in the scope of what they cover, you know, everything from ethics to law to how to speak, facilitate, etc. So, and they're available and they're free, a lot of them. So I highly recommend those just to get some
great
real grounding.
Linda.
Yeah. And I just think the best thing you can do is just be a very good listener. And one thing that I've had to learn is not to always put my experience onto another person's experience and be the container for their experience. And so it's just really meeting a person where they're at and to remember that it is their experience, even if they, it's different. I just really feel that's really important to be the container and be just a good listener.
Okay, I think we'll have time for one more, and I think this will have to be the last one. Unfortunately, I'm terribly sorry to have to do that because this
All
has been
right.
a great panel.
Laura Hernandez, you're up.
Okay, hello everybody. Thank you so much for this presentation. I really enjoyed what Linda said about PTSD in our community. And my question is, are there any type of initiatives that are being done to focus on the higher education institutions to connect services with students with disabilities and the counseling centers on campuses, because as we know, you know, traveling like through school, either an under, either getting an undergraduate degree or a graduate degree, we have to go through a lot of obstacles as far as accessibility, but it's also a mental strain on us to just like with any other student. And a lot of times when we go to services for students with disabilities, the counselors there are more geared to counsel for accessibility needs. So they send us over to counseling centers, and in the counseling centers, most of them have not like dealt with anybody who is blind or low vision. So the counseling kind of gets stuck on their experiences of what they would do if they lost vision. And that doesn't really help us to right. navigate right. The frustrations that we deal with, especially in post-grad situations. So right. my question right. is that, is there a way to link that for students? Thank you.
That's really good, yeah. I know one thing that I really appreciate you for bringing this up, because one thing when I was going through my school, my master's, we did diversity training, and they asked me, I was doing a class, I taught a class to clinicians, you know, potential clinicians about what it's like. And I went through all of it, and that needs to happen more. And it does need to be provided.
So I don't know if either Jessica Marquez or Catherine Schmidt-Whitaker are listening, but if you are, maybe you can communicate with the CCD students on that question, because that's a great question to which I have no answer. So I want to thank my panelists, Roque and Linda. I want to thank all of you who asked questions and made very cogent comments, and I hope that we continue to explore this issue, and remember when you're called upon to help us advocate for more services for people who have mental health challenges and who have vision loss. So thank you very much, and I'll turn it back over to
Rob.
Lisa, Rob. Okay, Rob. Sorry, Rob.
That's all right.
All yours.
Yeah. Well, thank you for what I thought was a great panel, and one of the things that came to my mind was when my dad was in his late 70s, he said, gee, I just wish I could have, helped you to found a way to enable you to see, you know, and I kind of said, well, it's all right, Dad. Now I realize that, as I get older, I think I can understand his point of view now, you know, cause we are limited. You know, we're told that blindness is just a nuisance, and that whole Federation philosophy, I think it's a little more than just a nuisance. But anyway, a good panel, and I really was glad to hear that. Is Lisa available? Apparently not.
No, I actually...
Oh, am. There she is.
I couldn't get off mute. So are you ready for a prize?
Time for a door prize.
Okie dokie, we're going to do another $25 Amazon gift card provided by the Fresno chapter. And the winner is Diane Harms. Congratulations.
Hey. Diane. From our Silicon Valley Council of the Blind chapter. Way to go,
you know,
Diane.
Your chapter's just been racking up the door prizes.
Apparently so, yeah. That's
that
right.
That means that we had a lot of Silicon Valley members that registered, right?
Yeah.
I think
Beautiful.
So. I think so. Yeah. So just a reminder, everybody, don't forget to visit our exhibitors. Check the list that Andrea sent out a day or two ago. And let's see if we can give them some good business. They're taking their time and energy to be with us, so please take advantage and visit with them.